Welcome to the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. We're on BitChute, we're on YouTube, a Speaking Podcast. I also have the Awakening Podcast, Learn Polish Podcast, and the Meditation Podcast. Today, my guest is a lady from California. Please welcome Kathy Groover.
Oh, thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm very good. I'm very good. So I always like to ask my guests, who's Kathy?
Oh, boy, that's a long story. I started out as an actor, actually, in Hollywood, and moved up to Santa Barbara to pursue a little more of the healing aspect of what I do. So I always had this parallel path of healing as far as like massage and things like that and performing. And after a while of having a massage practice here in town, I realized I wanted to reach more people. And so I started writing and I got my PhD, started studying more and more, got my certification as a hypnotherapist. And so it was the first time that the healing won out over the acting. It was the first time I started turning down theater to go do massage clients. So I knew I hit that pivotal point in my life. And then I started, like I said, writing more, and I realized I really wanted to get back on stage. And I knew acting wasn't the way to go. So I decided to take all those skills, combine everything, and get into public speaking, which I started doing about 10 years ago, I think. And it's flourished since then. So I've done tons of radio and TV. I just finished my 8th book yesterday. Wow. And been lecturing. Thanks. Yeah, I've been speaking around the world probably 250 times. I've been on 4 continents, a couple cruise ships, handful of islands. And I don't know where it's going to lead. I just keep saying yes and keep following the breadcrumbs. It's really exciting. I love what I do.
Impressive. Very impressive. So I always like to know your journey. I mean, you said you got into the acting, but when you were younger, how did you make the shift where you, I mean, acting is obviously being confident on stage. So yeah. Was it something as a child you were always kind of into the acting or?
Yeah. You know, I think just like every kid, I wanted to be a veterinarian after my first pet. I was so gung-ho about that. And then the pet died and I went, I don't want to do this for a living. I can't, there's no way I could go tell a little girl that her puppy died or something. So that left pretty quick. And then I went through archaeology. And I realized I didn't want to be an archaeologist. I wanted to discover King Tut's tomb, which they already did. So that was scrapped. And then I just always had a draw for stage. I got on stage for the first time when I was about 5. I was a ballet dancer as my mom's dream. So I was constantly in front of people performing. I was an only child. So I was around a lot of adults and they encouraged me to be, you know, outgoing and self-confident and things like that. So I was always on stage and I love teaching too. So I found that I was, you know, practically, you know, every place I went, I was educating somebody about something, which prompted me to learn more. So I don't think I'm ever going to stop learning because the more I get to learn, the more I get to help people. So it's just this cycle of, you know, learning, teaching. And I realized I could reach more people if I get on stage. So yeah, it was just a draw to get back on and it just made sense to me to get back up in front of people.
Brilliant. And like just from competitions, what I've noticed is those in the Toastmaster circuit, those that win tend to do acting. And that's so obviously it's a huge advantage when you're on stage.
Well, and it's funny because when I did my first TEDx talk, I'm very expressive. If you're watching the video of this, you know, I make a lot of faces and that's just how I am. One of the other TEDx speakers came up to me afterwards and he says, how do you do that with your face? And I went, what? And he goes, how do you do that with your face? And I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I doing? And I said, well, what do you mean? And he said, well, you're so expressive and like you smile when you talk. And I'm thinking, how can you not know how to move your face? I mean, like, but I guess it's the acting thing. You know, it's like I had to be expressive, especially when you're doing something, you know, subtle like TV or commercials. It can't be this giant thing. It has to be this subtle look versus stage where it has to be big so people in the back row can see you. So, but it was just, I never thought about that. You know, how do I do that with my face? I don't know. It's what I do.
And when you're doing a speech now, like say the TEDx, I'd love to go into your journey for that, how you prepared. And were you conscious then, or even the second one, of how you should be moving and how you should be moving your face? And because I've seen people, you know, they flick their hair at the exact certain time. And
you know, I think that's part of stagecraft. And the couple of times I've had the privilege of coaching other speakers, that's one of the things that I always ask is your body language, is your face in alignment with what you're saying? Because sometimes we actually don't know what this is doing and this reacts or responds before, you know, if somebody says something and we go, you can't take that back. And that's that knee-jerk reaction that in some cases we have to learn to control. That's been the joy of being a coach, is I can't do that when my coachee says stuff like that. So it is a matter of being conscious of what your body's doing, what your facial expressions are, your tone of voice. This is why I love encouraging people to watch themselves on video. And I know we hate that because we're our biggest critics, but you want to make sure that what you're communicating is in alignment with what your body's saying, what your face is saying. So I tend to be pretty conscious of what I'm doing and when I'm smiling and when I'm lowering my voice. And, you know, I think vocal quality is the other thing that's so incredibly important for a speaker. If you do the same thing at the same tone in the same voice, it's not as engaging. And I tend to be really conversational in my workshops and in my speeches, because it sucks people in. They don't want to feel like they're being talked at. They want to be part of that conversation. So I tend to make it very down to earth and funny. And I put humor in, and my slides are funny. And, you know, it's a whole show to me every single time you step on stage or do something like this.
Good. You mentioned you were on cruise ships. You were actually speaking on cruise ships. Was there any of them that were kind of doing, what's it like to be on stage when you're actually moving?
Well, it's interesting because there's not typically giant spaces on a cruise ship for speaking unless you're in the main showroom sort of thing. I spoke on, we can't call it a cruise ship. It's the world's largest privately owned yacht. It's called The World. And people actually buy residence on The World, and you travel from port to port, and you can get off if you want. If you stay on it, I think for 3 years, you will have seen everything in the world. Very cool. I did a whole week of nutrition talks for them. And I also said, you know, they said, what else can you offer? And I said, well, you know, I can teach hip hop. But I thought, who's going to want to learn hip hop on this yacht? And sure enough, every morning, five or six of the same people showed up, and we were in the hull of the ship, which is where you feel most of the rocking. So there's nothing like trying to jump and do hip hop when the boat is moving. So occasionally you'd jump and you'd not come down for a while. It was really disturbing. But yeah, it's interesting on a cruise ship because there's also not a lot of privacy. So people would wander through and come in and out. And yeah, it was a great experience. So I loved doing it. I'd love to get back on and do that some more.
I suppose it gets you used to distractions, so it's not throwing you off your train of thought.
Yes.
And you mentioned speaking on four different continents. Like, did you learn from that how you should engage with different types of countries?
Yes. So one of my first talks out of the country was in Jordan, and I knew nothing about Jordan. So I realized, so the humor that I would use in the States is going to make zero sense in Jordan. Same thing when I was speaking in South Africa, and I made sure I watched a couple of the other speakers to see how they engaged with the audience, to see what kind of humor they use. You know, I can't throw a Seinfeld reference out in Jordan. They're not going to understand what I'm saying. So I wanted to make sure I didn't offend anybody, because I know when I was doing children's theater, we did a lot of talks at schools with a lot of foreign students, and some gestures that make sense to us as Americans are offensive to people in other countries. So it was this head out of this extra heightened thing of what is my body doing? What are the gestures I'm using? What are words and phrases or things that they either might not understand or might find rude or offensive? So it takes a different level to the speaking. You know, you head to Europe, it's kind of pretty much the same everywhere. I speak in the UK every year, so that doesn't change much, but you really have to adapt to the audience you're speaking to. And I think it's one of the things we forget as speakers, is every audience is different. What keywords and phrases can you use that are going to engage them and not turn them off? So you have to be aware of who your audience is wherever you are.
Very nice. Yeah, very good. And I see you do trapeze.
I do trapeze.
I've never come across, I mean, I seen the pictures and I was like, wow. I mean, I honestly, I've jumped out of a parachute, out of a plane, you know, solo, but that kind of scares me because, you know, so it's how long have you been doing that, and how did you get into that?
I have been doing that for about 8 years, and I'm a total adrenaline junkie, and I love to experience things. To me, one of the joys of being in this world is getting to experience different things, different foods. This is one of the reasons I love traveling. I want to experience the local food. I don't want to go to where the tourist would go. I want to go to where the local goes. I want the local food, the local wine. I want to talk to the locals and get an idea of that culture. That's, to me, the joy of travel, but also just being in this world. And so I had a client so many years ago, and she said, you know, I went to your website and you write and you lecture and you, do you have time for anything fun? And I said, oh my God, I have tons of fun. And I kind of went through this adventure list of, you know, spelunking and rappelling and ziplining and parasailing and paragliding and jumping out of airplanes and swimming with sharks. She goes, okay, geez, what's left on your bucket list? What haven't you done? And I had to think about that for a second, because I don't really believe in a bucket list. I think so often we write this stuff down and then we shove it in a drawer and we never do it. And suddenly we're 80 and we go, oh, guess I'm not getting there. You know, why are we waiting with these things that we can do? If it's, you know, traveling around the world, it's some expensive, time-consuming thing. I get having to delay that. But if it's something as simple as a hot air balloon ride or horseback riding, or why are you not doing that thing? And so I said, I guess the next thing would be maybe flying trapeze. I'd love to try that. And then I realized, oh no, I said it. I got to go do it now. That's just the way my brain works. And so she was getting, you know, ready after her session, and I'm on the computer figuring out where I can go do flying trapeze. And I found myself 2 weeks later in Santa Monica on the pier, strapped into this rig and flying through the air. And it was the most incredible thing ever. And I thought it would be one-time thing. You do it, you're done. No, 8 years later, I'm still doing it. We have a setup here in Santa Barbara now. So I get to fly twice a week. I'm just about to get ready to do a show. It's really fun. It's a parallel for life. It's the best way to overcome your fears, because it's probably the safest way to get over the whole fear of heights thing, because you're strapped in and there's a net. So you kind of can't get much safer than that. But yeah, no, I talk about, actually my TEDx talks about trapeze. It's one of the components of my TEDx talk.
Yeah, no, I've listened to it, and I encourage people to actually listen to your TEDx talk. That it's actually good. I like the story the whole way through, the way you connected it. It was very nice. I totally agree with you regarding connecting with the locals, because you know, I go to a lot of different events around the world, mm-hmm. and people tend to stay in the resorts and just hang around with the same people and go to the, without experience the culture. And I always stay outside, stay in the local place, go to the local restaurant, and I tend to have 10 times more fun at a quarter or 10% of the price.
Well, and it's why, I mean, I can go to McDonald's anywhere. I mean, I'm not going to go there in the States anyway, but you know, it's like when I was in, and I tell this story in my TEDx too, when I was in South Africa, I wanted to go to the locals restaurant. And I found myself in this very traditional South African restaurant in the middle of Cape Town. And they brought me this very American menu. And I went, no, I want what you're going to eat. And so I ended up ordering warthog carpaccio, because when am I ever going to get that again? And if I don't like it, I don't have to eat it. But why would I not try that? To me, that's just one of the joys of, you know, getting outside your comfort zone, whether it's pushing yourself on stage as a speaker or as an author or just in life. Why are you sitting in the same booth in the same restaurant ordering the same pot pie every Saturday night? Try something else. It just expands us as humans. And to me, that's why I do what I do, is to help people expand themselves.
And like, obviously, you have zero fear for, you know, swimming with sharks, jumping out of planes, trapeze out. But like, say, with if you're coaching or with clients and they have the fear of public speaking, what advice would you give them?
Breathe. Identify what that fear is, because it's not the fear of public speaking. It's the fear past that. It's the fear of humiliation. It's the fear of looking stupid. It's the fear of dying. And if you ask those whys, eventually most fears you get down to the, but what if I die? You're not going to, you might bomb on stage. You're not going to die on stage. That's not something that typically happens. So it's a matter of, first of all, saying, well, why do you want to be a speaker? I understand, you know, I've coached people who they have to accept an award or they have to get up in front of their sales team. If you truly want to get on stage and educate people, figure out why you want to do that, why you have that fear. I also do hypnotherapy. Hypnotherapy is a great way to overcome fears of speaking. But you know, it's like, what do you want? And how can you tap into that part of yourself that is the extrovert? How can you tap into that aspect of your personality that is comfortable? Because anytime you step out of your house, you're public speaking. You know, whether it's talking to the guy at Starbucks or ordering your food in a restaurant, that's essentially public speaking. You didn't die. So if you could take that aspect of your personality, that brave part of yourself, tap into that before you get on that stage, it's going to be successful and so much easier to do what you need to do.
Oh, beautiful. And like, you've done the workshops you mentioned, yeah?
Yeah.
So I'm always curious how you organize your workshop, because everybody, are they like 2-hour workshops or full day, or or varies?
Yeah, it's whatever they pay me to do. it's like, because I've had people say, you do the typical hour keynote, you do the plenary session, the breakout. I have a stress program that can go from, I've done it in 12 minutes, it's not very thorough, to a 4-hour, half a day workshop where, you know, we get people up and we're doing self-care stuff and stretching, and I'm walking them through various meditations. And we're doing 10 minutes of gazing, which is where you just sit across from somebody and just meet their eyes without thought, have that connection. You have a meditation podcast, so you know. So it just sort of depends how long they want to be engaged with that. And then the challenge is, how do you keep somebody engaged for 4 hours, especially if they don't want to be there? And I did a workshop for 911 dispatchers who the last thing they wanted to do was sit there for 4 hours and learn about nutrition and stress reduction. And it was hard to keep them engaged. And some people were asked to leave because they were so not there. The supervisor was like, you know what? Other people need this. If you don't want to be here, get out. So they actually kicked people out of the workshop, which I felt bad about, but then I realized it's not my place to feel bad about that. They made a choice and then they made a choice. So.
But I think it helps because, I mean, it can be distracting when you are doing a workshop and people are just not there. So the reality is, yeah, I would agree with something like that, because I'd prefer to be in a room with 10 people that are totally present than 20 and they're just staring at their phones.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, we all have that nightmare of the thing, what if nobody shows up for our talk? I've had breakout sessions at 8 o'clock in the morning in New Orleans on the last day of the conference where I'm thinking no one's coming to this and the room ends up being packed. It's about managing those expectations and just sort of going with the flow and accepting what is and what happens.
Well, the main thing is to make sure you turn up, because
exactly.
I've seen that happen as well. I was at an event where the speaker didn't turn up. Yeah, he was out the night before and just kind of trotted it along an hour later. And yeah, the people were really annoyed with that.
When I was in Cuba, I went to the wrong room because nobody spoke English. So I actually misread the schedule, and I'm standing in this empty room surrounded by people who didn't speak English, wondering why my slides weren't up and why. And all of a sudden this woman goes, she barely spoke English. She goes, I think you're in the wrong room. And I kind of looked across the line and went, ah! So I was actually 10 minutes late for my own talk, which was humiliating. And then I fell off the dais. So that was a really exciting day.
But they all become stories that you're going to use later.
Exactly. Yeah, that was a scary one.
You mentioned the hypnotherapy. Yeah. Is that something that you'd have to do once, or is this something that people have to try? And like, what's the kind of entail?
Yeah, it depends on what they're coming for. So for example, I have a client who's going to have knee surgery tomorrow. She called me in a panic and went, I just realized I should have called you. I'm having surgery. So I saw her for one session yesterday. Pre-op hypnosis programs us to heal faster, to make sure our bodies yield to the surgeon's tools, to make sure everything recovers quicker. The subconscious is so incredibly powerful, especially when it comes to things like pain management and recovery from things. So for her, it's a one-time thing. We did the session, she'll have the surgery, it'll be amazing. I'm working with another person on test anxiety. She's got this huge exam to take. It's sort of the equivalent of the bar exam if you're going to be an attorney. And she's already taken it 4 times and failed. So she's got that in her subconscious now of I'm going to fail, so many things going on around that. And so I'm going to probably see her for 4 or 5 sessions before we get her to a place where she's ready to do that. So with things like speaking phobias or fear of flying or claustrophobia, I have people that wouldn't drive more than 15 miles away from their house. That's probably going to be multiple sessions. They're an hour each. The first half hour, 35 minutes is talking so that we can actually get to what the root of the problem is. And then we do 10 or 15 minutes of hypnosis. Sometimes I'll send them away with an MP3 so they can listen to it at night, or program that on a daily basis. It's such a great technique. It's one of my favorite things to do. I see the long-term effects of it and how beneficial it can be for so many different things. So yeah, I love using it. And I'm looking forward to this woman passing her exam and her calling me with exuberance telling me it worked. So.
And sometimes it's the people that have failed a few times end up being the best at that profession because they're so passionate, because a lot of people would walk away after failing once.
Right, exactly. Oh, she's got she's going to pass this thing. If it takes her till she's 90, she will pass this exam. This will be the last one, though. She's going to get this one.
Yeah, we'll keep our fingers crossed for her. So you may tell us about, 8 books you said. Which one started, and tell me about them.
Yeah, when I told someone I was at a conference, and I said, look, because when I first started going to conferences, I would watch the speakers and I would keep my notebook, and on the right side I'd take notes on the content, and on the left side I'd take notes on the speaker. Because as an actor and as someone that used to direct theater, I was appalled by some of the things I was seeing on stage. Some of the vocal, you know, they turn their back completely and read their PowerPoint. I'm sitting there going, no, we, why, you know, so stuff like that drove me crazy. And I remember turning to a friend of mine and saying, I'm going to be up there next year. He goes, yeah, you totally should. And I said, I have no clue what I'm going to speak on, but I'm going to be up there next year. He's like, good. Yeah, I think you should. And so I mentioned to somebody that I wanted to do more speaking, and they said, well, you have a book, right? And I said, no. I said, I want to be a speaker. And he said, yeah, you have to have a book. And I went, oh crap, I have to have a book. So I started formulating in my mind, well, what the heck book am I going to write? And so I had all these ideas percolating through. And then I realized I had so much content already written. I had content from blog posts. I had content from exercises and workshops and things I had to do for my PhD. I had articles that I had written for newspapers and you know, things like that. So I went, you know, I have content. So I put it all together. I reorganized it. I added some other pieces to it, and I called it the alternative medicine cabinet, because it was, you sort of just opened this book and went, oh, I'll grab this, oh, I'll grab that today. So it became this great little, I love this book, it's not even available anymore because I stopped having it published, but it just, that was sort of the jumping off point. And so once I had one, I realized, okay, it's sort of like a tattoo. I think you have to keep writing more. So then I took my dissertation on stress and mind-body medicine, and I turned that into two different books. And then I just kept writing them. And I realized I had so many things to share and so many stories to tell. And now they pretty much go along with my talks. So my stress talk has its own book. The book that I published yesterday is on communication. And that's one of my talks that I do. So, you know, it's the great way to allow people to continue their education after they've heard you speak. And also it's that back of the room money that sometimes, you know, that's the boost that takes you to that level of income that you want. So to me, it's a win-win for everybody. They get to learn more, they get to review what I just talked about, and I get to put a little extra money in my pocket at the talks. And it's fun. It's funny if they're short little books. I've had a couple published traditionally, a couple that I've published myself just because they're so small and more, you know, giveaway sort of thing. So yeah, I love coaching people on their book. I love helping people get their books published. It's one of my favorite things to do.
Brilliant. And you've been in a few different journals. Yeah, you've got a lot of publicity from. So, like, I mean, people want that. Is there a trick to that, or were you just lucky, or how did that come about?
Oh boy, I busted my butt for that. I've worked with PR people, and that was a weird shift for me, because as an actor, you know, you'd get an agent. You'd pay them 10% if they got you work, and the work paid. With a publicist or with a PR person, you pay them a lot of money every month and they get you things that don't pay. So that really confused me. That was a big shift for me to make. So I spent a lot of money on publicists trying to get me into things. I realized there's so many great sources that you can do on your own. There's something called HARO, H-A-R-O, which is help a reporter out. Yeah, I think it's helpareporter.com, where you know every day there's dozens of sources looking for, you know, outlets looking for sources. I was just on the Dr. Phil show, and they found me because of my website. It was a massage thing that they wanted me to talk about on the show. So I was just popped up on Facebook. This was 10 years ago today. I was on Lifetime Television talking about my first book. You know, they find this stuff. This is why it's so important to be on social media, tell people what you're doing, have a good website, make sure it's optimized. I don't pay to have it at the top of Google or anything like that, but it's just a matter of having, you know, putting those keywords in and being really honest in what you do, and then letting people know, you know, I'm going to be telling everybody my new book's out. You can't be shy about that stuff. Do radio shows, do podcasts, do things like that. Let people know what you're doing. If you want publicity, that's how to get it.
Very good. And I think you have a podcast, have you?
I do.
Yeah. What's it called and what's it about?
Yeah. So I co-host the Fire and Earth podcast with my friend Jason. We met through the National Speakers Association, and we were at one of the meetings, and we just had this great rapport, and it was almost this sort of brother and sister, like playfulness, teasy kind of thing. And he just kept popping into my mind, and I finally contacted him and I said, this sounds really weird, but I think we need to work together. Like, I feel like we're supposed to be doing something. And he's like, great. And so we talked about doing a retreat. We had this whole retreat planned out. And then we got to the end of this planning and went, wait, who the hell knows who we are? Why would they come to our retreat? And I went, oh, yeah, no, that's a good point. And so we thought, how do we spread the word about who we are? Hey, I've always wanted to do a podcast. And so we fueled each other. And, you know, after a couple of weeks of brainstorming and what are we going to call it? That was the hardest thing. What are we going to call the podcast? We came up with Fire and Earth Podcast. I think we're in our second year. We've got 120 shows out there, tons of amazing guests and really fun shows with just the two of us. And it's about just unlocking your potential. So we've had everything on from business consultants to organizational psychologists to regular psychologists talking about mental wellness to an astrologer who fills us in on what's coming in the year to be, to spiritual, you know, consultants. And we run the gamut. So it's so much fun, little half hour shows. Yeah, it's really a blast. It's something I look forward to every recording every couple of weeks.
And how do you find doing a co-host, you know, like that somebody's not talking over the other person or somebody's taking, you know, control of it?
I don't know. I mean, we just really fell well into that. And I've been a guest on shows where they have more than one host. And you're right. It could become a nightmare because they're in different locations. They're not seeing each other. This is one of the things I love about the video is you can take that cue of, oh, okay, he's done talking. Jason and I just work really well together. And we've had so many guests who have said, I love being on your guys' show because you have such great rapport. I tend to be a little more like, ah, and he's a little slower and a little more thoughtful. He has a background in accounting and like tax audit kind of stuff, whereas my background's theater. So he's the low key one and I'm the little more frenetic, excited one. So yeah, we play off each other really well. It's a matter of just finding the person that works, you know, whether it's dating or marriage or business partner or podcast co-host, you just have to have that rapport and kind of work out how it's going to work. Set those rules, make those boundaries known before you get started.
Good. And with the new one, the communication book, what tips would you give people for being better communicators?
Yeah, it's about being present is one of the main things. And, you know, we all say what's the most important thing about communication is listening. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. But you can't hear if you're not here. I can do that active listening thing of and still be thinking about something else. So how do you shut out all that other stuff and be present? How do you let the person finish their sentence without you finishing it in your head? How do you not assume you know what they're going to say? How do you not let it bring up a past circumstance of, oh, my dad always used to say that. And I hate when they say, and suddenly you're off on something else and they haven't been able to communicate fully what they want. In communicating what you need, it's important to know what you want. You know, why did you just say, hey, I took out the trash? Are you saying it to rub it in their face that they were supposed to and they forgot and you did it? Is it to say, I know you're really busy today and I care about you, so I took out the trash? You know, if you don't know what you want, you can't communicate it. You don't jump into an Uber and say, take me somewhere. You have to give them a destination. And that's one of the big things I see is people don't express what they actually want. And then they're mad if they don't get what they want. What do you want? You know, I think asking for clarification is huge. I've had coaching clients say, my boss said, make it better. I'm like, okay, what does that mean? Well, I don't know. I felt bad asking. You have to clarify things like that, you know. I don't know what make it better means. Do you want it longer? Do you want more words? Do you want puppets? Do you want, you know, bigger font? I don't know what make it better means. And if you're all working together in an organization, you have to clarify that or else the job's not going to get done or it's not going to be done well and it's not going to benefit the company. So I think there's, you know, I put some really simple tips in. I have a whole section on motivational speaking and how to get more comfortable with that. And then I talk about something called ego states, which is one of my favorite things, which is sort of what we talked about before, is just tapping into those different parts of yourself, that brave part of you, you know, that funny part of you. How do you bring that aspect of yourself forward? And it's about identifying those parts, mapping those parts, knowing what job they do. And then from that, you can call forward whatever aspect of yourself you need. You know, we all have 15 to 20 that we see often. And so it's a matter of just knowing who they are, that team, and calling the right teammate forward when it's needed.
Very nice. And did you eventually do that retreat when you got your podcast going?
No, because COVID hit.
Oh.
Yeah, we will. We will. He's in Los Angeles and I'm in Santa Barbara. And we started talking about, you know, what does it look like? What will we do? Trapeze was going to be one of the things. I hosted a retreat, a women's empowerment retreat, I guess 2 years ago now in the Dominican Republic. And It was, we did yoga, we did a river float, we did hip hop, we did improv, we did trapeze, you know, and everybody loved those sort of out of the ordinary things that they could step into and do. And then we did, you know, guided visualization, we did some coaching, things like that, some free time, enough to be able to relax a little bit. So yeah, we'll Jason and I will get there. We just have to let everything trickle down in the world first.
When you're creating the retreat, like, I mean, you mentioned all the different things you've done, and the one that you're doing it on in like an Excel sheet that you're going, okay, we'll do this. It's going to take so many hours, and then we leave them, have a breathing space. Then we do it. You break it down to kind of.
Yes. That makes my Capricorn very happy. That's one of my big ego states is that organized Capricorn. Yeah. I mean, I didn't want to schedule it down to the minute. But for me as facilitator, I also needed to know, look, how much time is it going to take for me to get ready for blah, blah, blah. You know, so some of the activities were optional. The trapeze was optional, though, frankly, most women who signed up, that's why they signed up. They wanted to do the trapeze. So I had a friend that had a trapeze rig at a resort in the Dominican Republic. And knowing he was there, that's what sparked the entire retreat. You never know where these ideas, you know, where these little sparks of brilliance are going to come from. So yeah, I actually did have an Excel spreadsheet. Everything was color coded. I had everything laid out that morning of what would I need, because I had different coaching activities, you know, maybe card decks that I needed, books that I was going to give to everybody. I got sponsors for gift bags. So everybody went home with a lot of really nice stuff. It took a lot of organizing. But it was really fun. It was one of my favorite things. And you know, I had planned to do it every year, and then COVID hit. So between Jason and I, and then my own stuff, I'll be doing more, definitely doing more.
Yeah. I mean, I would have thought, I've never organized one myself, but I would have thought a lot of work, but then plenty of, because I've been on like plenty of bonding that you connect so well with people. I know that, you know, that gives value in itself, you know, irrespective of the monetary value from it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the advantage of where I did is it was an all-inclusive resort. I used the term resort loosely, but it was all-inclusive. So we didn't have to worry about meals. You know, they organized the activities for us. They had a space to do yoga. They had a space to do improv. They had a space to do the trapeze. So I didn't have to do much. They handled all the payments. So in that way, it was really easy. It wasn't like I tried to find a location and then find all this other stuff. So if you're going to organize one, doing something like that was a huge benefit to doing it there.
Brilliant. With the coaching, so you're doing the coaching with people. What advice would you give? Because I'm always curious with people doing the coaching, because there's plenty of coaches out there, and you know, there's a lot of people out there that just, you know, they study for 2 hours and then they're the coach. Like, I mean, obviously you've got massive experience, and just by listening to, I know straight away you're going to give huge value, but like, how can you maybe give people advice on the coaching side of things?
That's a great question. I tend to be a rebel with things like training when it comes to things like that. And I realized that with the massage, you know, I've been doing it for so long, and people tell me everything on the table. People tell me things they should not be telling me, but I went, okay, it's your time. You know, I don't know that you should be saying that. Okay, cool. You know, and I would just sit in that space and I would take what they're saying, and I would either ask them questions about it, or I'd say, you know, do you want advice on that? Or do you want a resource on that? And I started to realize that I liked the talking almost more than the pushing on the knot that they had in their shoulder. So I thought, well, let me start doing some hypnosis, which again is so much talking and then ending with this hypnotic state. And I realized I like the talking a lot more than sometimes putting the person actually in the state of hypnosis. And so several people had said, well, you know, why are you not coaching? And I said, well, look, everybody's a coach. I don't want to call myself a coach. Everybody and their mother's a coach. I need a different word. So I sat down with a couple of my business friends and I'm like, I need a different word. And they're like, Kathy, it's coach. I'm like, no, I don't want to call myself a coach. I don't. And I'm not trained as a coach. I don't have certification as a coach. They're like, I don't think you need to. You have all this experience. You have all the, just call yourself a coach. And so I finally gave in and went, okay, fine, I'm a coach. And then I thought, okay, I need training. And you know, if I'm going to do this thing, if I'm going to call myself a coach, I actually do want training in it. So I enrolled literally about a year and a half ago. Great school out of, I think, somewhere near San Francisco. And I was doing the training in Los Angeles, driving down and doing it. And then COVID hit. So I ended up doing the rest, you know, virtually. They had virtual classrooms set up with 20 students. And it was the greatest thing I did. It was so much fun. And so there was so much value in that to me of doing a program. Was I a good coach before? Sure. But now I actually have really structured tools and, processes that I didn't know before. And now I'm in the midst of getting nationally certified too, because I thought, you know, if I'm going to do this and this is something I can do the rest of my life, why not do it? You know, why not do it full out and do it? You sure, anyone can call themselves a coach. And for a while I did, having no training. You know, I mean, I have all this experience that I brought to it, but I have to say there is something to doing the training and getting the certification. It holds you accountable and it does make you look more professional. And a lot of sites where they will list coaches like for you to find won't list you unless you're certified with the national, at least in the States, national, it's an international federation. So yeah, I recommend doing the training. It gave me such value that I didn't think I'd get.
And is it a kind of a continuous thing that you have to do so many hours of training or research and stuff? Yeah, because similar to the PMP, project management professional, that, you know, because that happens even with doctors, like unless you're kind of, you know, sharpening the saw, how are you the same person 20 years later?
Exactly. And to me, I love tools. And that was one of the things when I started doing hypnosis, is I sat down with my Excel spreadsheet and I went through all of my classes. I went through all of the workshops I had done. I went through all of my notes and I organized it all so that if I'm in the middle of something, I can look to that sheet and go, oh my God, I got the perfect system for you. Or, oh, I've got the perfect induction for you. Or same thing with coaching. I literally sat down with my 30 years of experience of doing all this stuff and wrote down everything that I've learned, either that other people have taught me or that I learned in therapy or that I read in that book that I was reading, because I read medical books for fun. Who doesn't? And, you know, I organized that all, which put it in the front of my mind so that I can pull from that buffet of tools and exercises to give to the people that are sitting in front of me. And that was huge value to me to have that in one spot of, this is what I can do with these people.
Good. And are you doing speeches now online? And what kind of, because it's a different experience, especially with the acting part and everything.
Yeah. I don't like it. You can tell by the look on my face is doing something. I had to pivot pretty quick with that. And it was a huge bummer, because 2020 was the year that I had, I think, 5 organic keynotes booked, like full fee, really well-paid keynotes. And so many of them went away. The conference was just flat out canceled. They weren't like, let's see what happens. It was just nothing. So that was a huge disappointment. And I had almost felt like I lost so much momentum, because for 7 years I'd been doing free talks and doing the self-promotion. And I felt like all that work was lost, because now for 2021, what am I spinning off of? I didn't do anything to spin off of. So I felt, feelings are not facts, I felt that I had not wasted, but lost all of that time and momentum. That has proved to be wrong. I just went through yesterday and organized all my talks so far for 2021. And we're now, it's what, the end of January. And I've got like 10 things booked, some of which are lower fee online things, and some are in-person full fee keynotes. So I didn't lose what I thought I was going to. Fearing the future. It's a thing we do. What I realized with the online things is I have to pretend that everyone's just as engaged, even if I'm recording it. I have to just assume they're laughing at what I know I just said was funny. I have to assume they're doing the exercises, and I have to respond as if I'm watching them respond. Because I'm sure my first couple webinars, they were good. They were good. I don't think they were as engaging as they could have been, because I wasn't pretending that there was somebody sitting in front of me. And I realized I've got to suspend that disbelief and actually, you know, there's one exercise I do where typically when, at the end of it, everybody laughs. And so I just have to assume that though they're sitting in their house in their sweatpants with their cat and their glass of wine, maybe, that they still laughed at that. And so I had to react as if I watched them laugh. And that made it so much fuller, and I'm having so much more fun with it now. So that was something I had to shift. I had to forget that there wasn't an audience in front of me.
Oh, that's very good advice. Yeah, because I've done a lot of Toastmasters and competitions and everything. It is strange because, you know, a lot of times, especially for the competitions, they turn off the camera, so you don't see people's reactions. And it's strange. But that is very good advice, what you just said. And with the keynote, because some people want to be doing keynotes, what kind of tips, advice can you give on that, on giving a keynote?
Boy, I wish I knew. You know, I did a lot of free talks, a lot of paying my own travel to get to places, to make those connections. And, you know, there was one organization that I think I've spoken for 5 times. I love the organization. They do like emergency number 911 response. They're not 911 dispatchers, but they're a communication organization. And my first year with them was I did a little stress talk for them. The second, they were like, oh my God, we loved your stress talk. What else do you have? I said, oh, I do this communication thing. Great. The next year it was, we want you to do a 4-hour workshop. Now, none of this was paid. So I was paying my own travel. I was paying my own way, but I was giving back to this organization that I felt so strongly about. And I now have done 2 webinars for them, which I got paid for. And now I was just asked to do one of their keynotes at full fee. So, you know, it's about building those relationships. I could be the greatest speaker in the world, but if the person doesn't know that I'm the greatest speaker in the world, how am I getting that booked? You know, I have reached out to organizations. I have done mailings. I have done emails. I have done LinkedIn. I've not found that to be overly beneficial. And maybe it's the way I'm doing it. I am not great at that reaching out thing. But to me, it's building those relationships and doing just damn good work. And so that someone sitting in that audience goes, they've got to come to our talk. And that's typically how I get my stuff. So-and-so just saw you speak and she said, we have to have you. And, you know, it is about those spinoffs, which is where I felt that I lost so much in 2020. But I'm still getting, you know, I just got a couple spinoffs from some of the online workshops that I did. They saw it and went, oh my God, you're amazing on camera. You've got to be incredible in person. We want you to do this workshop. So it's about doing good work. It's about making those connections, following up with those connections. You know, it's a lot of legwork. If you think you're going to just sit back and they're going to come to you, no. If you think you're going to do a TEDx or a TED Talk, not everybody's Brené Brown. They're not just going to come to you. It's not going to launch you to stardom. That's not the point of a TEDx or a TED Talk. It's about being in that space, in that location, and sharing your message, sharing those ideas. It's not about building your brand. And a lot of people want to do a TED Talk because they think it's going to, you know, launch them to national fame. It's probably not. Sorry. Neither is your book, frankly. You know, let's be honest. Your book's not going to make you a millionaire either, probably. So.
No, that's actually fantastic advice, because a lot of people, they think that, you know, they get confident as a speaker and they expect that, they'll just turn on their website and people can start knocking on the door with the checkbooks. And what you've just said is basically what you have to do. You go on stage, you give great value, and there's someone sitting there that's actually the CEO of some other company, and they go, yeah, I like this girl. I want her to speak for me.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I had a dear friend when I first started my speaking career. He's a fellow hypnotherapist. He's probably one of the busiest people I know. I mean, like he's incredible. And he was kind enough to drive me to the airport after one of our hypnotherapy conferences. And we were talking about speaking. And I said, Paul, tell me everything you know. Like, we have 20 minutes to get to the airport. Tell me everything you know. And he said, I'll tell you this. There are 3 reasons I speak. And I went, oh, okay. He said, 1, they pay me. I mean, let's be honest. It's a job. They pay me. I show up. I do my thing. Whether I like them or not, they pay me. I show up. And I went, okay, cool. I said, what are the other 2 reasons? And he said, the other 2 reasons are, 1, it's an organization that I value, that I want to give back to, or it's a conference I'd be at anyway. And that way I get to go to the conference for free. I went, okay, cool. So what's the 3rd reason? He said, it's someplace in the world I want to go. So I've done, this is how I've gotten on 4 continents. I've found talks in cities and countries that I want to go to so that I can go there for business and then spend a day or two or a week wandering around. You know, use speaking as an opportunity to see those things that you want to see, to go travel the world and have those, you know, experiences and opportunities that you want. That's one of the joys of what we do. And I will get on all 7 continents, Antarctica. Yeah, we'll try. Maybe not, but at least I got 2 more to get to that I want to, you know. It's, I want to collect the whole set now. And I can do that through speaking. It's been one of the greatest things in my life to get to have these experiences that I otherwise wouldn't have gotten to.
No, I love it. I love it. Listen, Heavy, it's been fantastic. Loved everything that you've told me. How can people get in contact with you?
Yeah. So the best is my site, which is KathyGruver.com. It's Kathy with a K, Groover with a V-E-R. KathyGruver.com, also KathyGruver.coach. All my books are there. How to book me for speaking gigs, how to do some coaching. Yeah, and I'm all over social media, so I love getting connected with her.
Brilliant. And I love that on the podcasting description, so people will be able to find the links for you. So thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So that's all for the Speaking Podcast. You can find all our episodes on speakingpodcast.com. You will find us on BitChute and YouTube. Please give us a 5-star rating. Thumbs up. Until next week, take care.